I'm Dime Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to music by composer and violinist Joe Kai. He'll be giving an online concert on May 9th at 7 p.m. and find out more at albertarosetheater.com. Truly strange times we're living in. It's been 7 weeks since sheltering at home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. I've been out for a walk or go read outside. My husband shops once a week, but mostly life hasn't been too much different since I work at home, unless I have a theater project. But for most people, it has been a challenging time, and I hope everyone listening right now is safe and healthy. The arts have been undergoing a state of metamorphosis. So many artists, technicians, and staff people have lost wages and jobs. Performing arts, galleries, museums also have gone through much self-reflection about what they can do to make their buildings, their stages, their exhibit halls safe for audiences as well as for their artists and staff. To think through what changes are needed for the arts world to return to public interaction, I talk with veteran journalist Bob Hicks. He's been nominated twice for the Pulitzer. Hicks worked for 25 years at the Oregonian as an arts editor and writer, and he's currently working as senior editor of Oregon Arts Watch, which has been covering the changes and upheaval of the arts during this pandemic. I encourage everyone to visit this online magazine at orartswatch.org. Just how can performing artists really make a comeback after all this? Well, we're going to talk about that with Bob Hicks in this conversation, so stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio, talking with Bob Hicks, senior editor of Oregon Arts Watch, an online magazine. Bob, we're living in a really unprecedented time in the country, a pandemic lockdown in which most of the country is staying home. And I just want to tell you personally, you know this, I'm sure, but when Governor Brown gave the order to ban large gatherings in Oregon, that was on March 11th, and I had just directed the Journal of Benuchita at Oregon Children's Theater. And I want to share with you that the actors were in the middle of their run at the time, and they came to the theater one night to perform, and they were told there would be no show. And it was sort of this weird thing where they were in this empty theater and, you know, they were ready to perform and they had to go home. And so Oregon Children's Theater not just canceled that performance, but the rest of their run. And then, you know, there seemed to be a closure almost every day after that, some announcement. And I'm sure you got tons of press releases about that with every new company, not just theater, but dance companies, visual arts, museums, everybody was closing. Ever since March 23rd with the stay-home mandate, you know, except for essential services, everything seemed to just shut down. What was that time period like for you, just witnessing all of that?
Yeah, it was really strange. And also for the record, I had been planning to see that show, but I didn't get to it before you shut down.
And that's what always happens anyway, but this was like you had no choice, you know?
Yeah, it was... I think that we were anticipating it before it happened because everything was pointing that way. At first, we thought, well, maybe museums can stay open because they can control the number of people who go in at any particular time. But as you recall, they sort of rolled the numbers. At first, I think it was nothing... more than 250, no gathering more than 250 people. So they thought, well, some of the small theaters could keep going, but still they're all stuck in the same space with everybody. And then from 250, it went down to 50, I think. And then at some point it went down to 10 and then it just disappeared. I mean, this was just a fracture, a compound fracture, because it just kept breaking and breaking and breaking. And for us, that as huge and sharp a change as it was for companies, what we needed to do in terms of cultural journalism was figure out, oh, what are we going to do now? What are we going to write about? How are we going to handle this? A lot of it was just
playing on the streets reporting, this place closed, this place closed, this place is postponed until such and such a date, but they don't really know whether they'll have to postpone again. And then we got to the point where we were thinking, well, what is this going to mean long range? How are we going to report on that sort of thing? And it's like, it was a bit like trying to report from the middle of the San Francisco earthquake. The ground kept shifting underneath you. So anytime you describe something, it was changing already. And I think that's still where we stand.
I'm glad you referred to another, you know, like a disaster of the earthquake, because we have lived through a lot of different times, right? We've lived through the AIDS crisis. We've lived through, you know, so many wars and economic recessions. I mean, there have been, you know, 9/11. I can point to all these different times and all these milestone times, and now we're in the middle of another milestone time that could be extended for quite a long while. And it's going to have an impact for the long term, I think, in how we view the arts as the public, but also how people perform in the, you know, in the arts or produce the arts or show their art. You know, I'm wondering about the type of stories that you've been able to cover besides the shutdowns, which are horrible. I mean, I just read the story about White Bird. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival, all kinds of places, Portland Center Stage. I mean, every single theater had to shut down. The dance companies also had shows in the spring, too. They also cut, you know, had to shut down besides White Bird. So what are the types of stories you've been reporting on Arts Watch?
Well, a lot of it has been what are people doing in the interim? How are they surviving? We've talked to a lot of individual artists about how this has changed their lives, what they're doing in the meantime. We've talked with, we've done a lot more on recorded arts. Brett Campbell recently did a roundup of Oregon jazz recordings in the past couple of years. Sit down and listen to these. As you know, a lot of theaters are there are things like the National Theater doing its free streams of recorded shows, which are not the same thing as sitting in a theater and seeing a piece of theater, but they're what's available right now.
Oh, I have to say though that Jane Eyre that they streamed 2 weeks ago was phenomenal. And I really felt like I had a chance to go to London.
I know, it's pretty nice. Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah. It's interesting. When they did One Man, Two Governors with James Corden, it was like I started watching it and I'm thinking, this would be terrific on stage. You see things and you think, oh, I see where this is going, but it's heightened, it's exaggerated because it's kind of almost in a Restoration comedy style, which doesn't work as well on film as it does on stage. It's a different sort of artificiality. Film is artificial also, but in different ways. But then James Corden came on, and he was just like this bowling ball crashing through everything, and suddenly it didn't make any difference, because what he was doing was more like what a stand-up comedian does, and that works really well on film. So that kind of, for me, changed the whole dynamic of the piece. I mean, I think we have to recognize that most of theater done on film is a next best thing. It's not the real deal. For some reason, I think opera works better on film than theater does. And I think maybe it's because voice, the music, and the spectacle are take primacy over the words, and words tend to take primacy in theater. So that works better. But, you know, that's kind of like complaining that you had to put margarine instead of butter on your bread. It's, if that's what's available, that's what you use.
Well, we're seeing a lot more online performances. I mean, just personally with Media Rights, the tour that we had planned for the ISM project had to be canceled. You know, we had spring and summer tour. And so we're trying to figure out ways to put it online. And so you have to change, you have to adapt the material
right.
to be online,
right.
to be a film. So, you know, it depends on, you know, how you do it, I think. So we've been seeing some of that beyond what's national, but even locally, people are producing play readings. Bag and Baggage just did a sequestered soliloquies. And soliloquies,
right.
I mean, and I think, you know, Vanport Mosaic, which the ISM project is going to be part of, is going to be doing a whole month of these kind of, you know, I call them living room performances.
Yeah. It's going to be really interesting to see how they change, because they're such a cultural asset, and everything they have done has been, it's fairly easy to take their gallery shows and put them online. Their performances are a little bit different, but the sort of show that you're taking there to Vanport Mosaic, because so much of that is solo pieces, or it can be easily adapted as solo pieces, that could work really well, I think. And I think that's the sort of thing we're going to be seeing a lot of. I think of, I don't think that they have any plans to do this, but for instance, what Portland Story Theater does with an individual person standing on stage telling her or his story, that would adapt well. What Sankar Rahman is doing with the immigrant story, some of those things, I think, could work really well. Old-fashioned theater with a bunch of people close together interacting is going to be tough, because, yeah, you can film it, but can you really ask the actors to do that?
Well, yeah, that's the safety issue isn't just for the public. We're going to talk about that, too, but also for the actors, too, right? Because how many
yeah.
people can you put into a space? And I just read a piece that Actors Equity is working with Obama's former OSHA administrator to look at safety and health conditions that would need to happen for the actors.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
also, you know, a lot of theaters nationally are consulting health experts to see how they can make it more attractive for, you know, for the audience. What guidelines do they need to have in order to be able to invite an audience and make them feel safe again to come into the theater and healthy, right? So
yeah, yeah.
sanitizers, masks, what is the spacing going to be like? And I don't know. What do you? I think that art always adapts somehow.
Yeah, I think it's going to look very different. To think that we are going to go back to normal is, I think, mistaken. Certain things you can go back to, and certain things you just can't, and certain things you can phase in. But this issue particularly, how close can actor A be to actor B? That's basic. And that's the same sort of issue that that nurses and doctors and grocery clerks face. It's a matter of survival. And if you're doing a play, it's one thing for the clerk at the grocery store to be wearing a mask and gloves. It's a very different thing for an actor to do that. Because, it just is. So I think it's going to be very tough for theaters. I think it's going to be tough for musical groups. And I also think that audiences are going to take a while to feel that it is okay to go back into a crowded hall. And how is it going to work out economically? If, say, you have a 200-seat theater and you're used to selling 85-90% of your seats every performance, but suddenly, because you still have to have social distancing, you have to cut that down to 40% of your house every performance so that everybody can be spaced apart from one another. How do the economics of that work out? How then do the costs of production match the income at the box office? Can you afford to do a piece of theater even if you can get some audience in and you can get the actors sufficiently spaced that you can do the and blocked that you can do the show. And you're also, and on top of that, every company of any kind is going to be in facing financial crisis because so many costs have piled up on them. If you own or lease your building, you've had to keep those payments up, most likely. But you've had no income. You look at traditional funders, foundations, for instance, where you're used to getting a large chunk of your income so you can do your performance as well. Their priorities may have shifted. They may be saying, it's more important for us to put our money into primary health care, emergency funding, than it is to put it into doing theater or dance or concerts. And in a way, it's hard to blame them for that. At the same time, what foundations give out is based on, to a large extent, on their endowments and how the stock market is doing. And the stock market has not been doing well because it's in crisis also. So the amount of money that foundations have to disburse is going to be smaller. Everybody's in crisis at the same time. If a few are in crisis now and again, you can handle it. When everybody's in crisis, it's a free-for-all. And I don't think we know how those chips are going to fall.
Well, I think you're right about that. And, you know, even the economic recovery loans, you know, recently went to a lot of the larger banks. I found were more inclined to give the money to larger businesses as opposed to the arts. And then the smaller banks actually had, I guess, like credit unions and, you know, less well-known banks actually were able to save a chunk for arts organizations or small organizations and small business. So, you know, that all needs to be worked out too. But also it loss of revenue is vital, you know, to anybody's security and future. But what I'm also wondering is how arts can adapt. You know, we've seen some online exhibitions. We talked about online performances, perhaps streaming the shows as well as, you know, selling patron tickets, but also making that available. That means, you know, playwrights have to give up some of those rights. I think we have to see a shift in the way things are being done, you know, and be able to be more open about sharing our work, you know, digitally. And that has been that's been a difficulty for a lot of, you know, unions and also guilds, you know, to protect the artists' rights, but also the arts also hire a lot of people. So we need to keep hiring people in order to do that. It has to adapt.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that that's something that gets lost in the economic shuffle. People, decision makers, political decision makers often don't make the simple connection that arts workers are workers. It's not a hobby. It's what you do for a living. It's what you've trained to do. It's what you're better at than other people are. But traditionally, I mean, even in good times, arts are way down the list in terms of funding. And these are not good times. So I think we will see some companies disappear. I think some companies will do everything right, and it still won't work out for them. So much depends on how long this lasts and what form recovery in general takes. Will there be inoculations at work? How long will that take? The arts can't come back quicker than the rest of the economy, and they probably will come back less quickly because in our culture, that's where arts stand. Whether we like it or not, whether people who do it and believe in it like it or not, the arts are not considered very important in American culture.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts talking with Bob Hicks, senior editor of Oregon Arts Watch. Hear the podcast on stageandstudio.org or kabu.fm/stageandstudio. Would you ever, as a cultural reporter, reviewer, consider reviewing online work?
You know, that's a really interesting question, Ime, and we've been thinking about that. Other than musical recordings, I don't think we've done it yet. We might. I think that we've decided so far that covering the larger picture is more important than doing specific reviews. On the other hand, I think traditionally what a lot of people look to us for are those reviews. Can we do both? Can we afford to do both? Our funding is a little different from most arts groups because we exist virtually. We don't have a palpable product other than what's online. Our costs are, we don't lose as much in this kind of situation. On the other hand, we don't have a way of selling tickets. What we do is free. What we offer is free, and we are supported by foundations, by some government grants, by individual donations, and in that sense, we're the same as every other group. All of a sudden, all the hands are out at once, and there's a limited number of people who can put things in those hands. Our supporters have been really good, but it seems obvious to us that our budget's going to have to go down in the next year. How much, we're not sure. It's not life-threatening for us the way it is for a lot of other people because we carry no debt. We don't have any physical plant to support. But we do pay our people who work for us. And if we don't have money to pay them, we don't write stories. I think that we'll probably be looking a little leaner, but we'll be here, and we'll just be a little more careful on what we cover, how many stories we cover. I think that we will come out of it better than a lot of other places will, just by the nature of being journalism rather than producing art.
Well, Bob, one final question. What does a theater, a gallery, you know, a dance or concert hall have to do to make you feel safe, you personally, safe about entering that space again?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not sure it's so much a question of what they do as what happens in the larger culture. I think the big thing for me personally would be, is there a vaccine that is reliable that I can have and that will say, okay, chances are pretty slim that you're going to come down with something life-threatening. I think for me, that's what it's going to take. I don't think I want to walk in at this point with things the way they are right now. I don't think I want to walk into a theater and even if they're only selling every third seat, I'd rather stay home.
Yeah, I'm afraid that I'm sort of in the same boat too, because you know, all it takes is one cough in that theater space, and I'm like, I'm out of here. You know, so
And it's a problem. So I think really the big thing is, how long does this last? And none of us knows that right now. We can know by looking at other places like South Korea, which clamped down really quickly and really hard.
Taiwan, New Zealand, I mean, they all have emerged okay, you know.
But, you know, it's too late for us. We're beyond that point. So we have to wait for things to slow down. And you look even in Oregon. Oregon is very mild, but we've got 100 deaths in the state now. And they clump in the greater Portland area because that's where most of the population is. It's nothing like New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. But it's enough. It's enough. I haven't been to the grocery store in 7 weeks.
Well, we're living for the day when, you know, things can be some semi-normalized, you know. So let's hope for the best. And you stay healthy. Yeah. You stay well. Bob Hicks, senior editor of Oregon Arts Watch, thank you for joining me via FaceTime today. And you can stay in touch with our arts community by visiting orartswatch.org. So good talking with you, Bob.
Great. Yeah, you too. Thanks, Kimmy.
That was Bob Hicks, veteran journalist at Oregon Arts Watch. And you can find the link at orartswatch.org. Before we go, I want to highlight the virtual Vamport Mosaic Festival. Vamport usually does a month-long festival of theater, pieces, films, walking tours, and art exhibits. And it's usually located throughout North Portland. But this year it's going to be May 8th through the 30th, and it's all online. And most of these events will be streamed on Facebook Live, and you can find out more ways to find out about it on stageandstudio.org and kbu.fm/stageandstudio. But the festival is going to be pretty inclusive. It's going to have poets, writers, films. Some of the artists include Native American storyteller Ed Edmo, musician Michelle Fuji, poetry from Ken Yoshikawa, Lakayana Drury, and Aaron Springs, theater artist Damaris Webb, and also there's going to be a conversation with activist and dancer Jizao Hata. My organization, Meteorites, will also be presenting two performances, and they're going to be followed by conversations about COVID-19 anti-Asian American Pacific Islander racism. Now we're going to go out with music by Joe Kai, and I want to tell you about his online concert on May 9th at 7 p.m. It's hosted by Alberta Rose Theatre, and Joe Kai is such a talented violinist, looper, composer, and storyteller, and he's based in Portland, although he toured internationally, and we hope that he will be able to tour internationally again. He's going to be performing a solo concert live stream to your living room. All of this is living room art as far as I'm concerned, so I hope you can support it. Now, Joe's concert, you can find out more at albertarosetheater.com. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you for listening. You can hear the show again at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio and like us on facebook.com/stage_studio. I'm going to try to keep doing these new shows and report on what's happening in our own community in the arts. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope that you'll tune in again next week. So till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
No, I am no longer scared. But I find that I'm reaching for the glue. So stick on me and go. Lick your wounds and we'll grow together. So stick on me and go. Lick your wounds and we'll grow together. So sick.